Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, places, stories, and events in Central Iowa. It's good to get together again to provide facts to our community through Zoom technology and the spoken word. Thank you for listening. I am Mike Metz, your host for the hour, sitting in for Pat Schlierbaum, and with me is engineer Mike Murphy. We will be joined later in the hour by Susan Guiazda and Keith Abram. The weather for today will be partly sunny, with Fahrenheit highs in the 90s, a potential for a few pop-up thundershowers later in the afternoon, and an overnight low near 61. This weekend, though, we can expect cooler daytime temperatures initially, but they will creep up to the mid to upper 80s, and there will be significant chances of thundershowers on Sunday. But for the start of the next week, we will expect highs in the mid-70s, so a little cool-off, we hope. Now let's welcome Dennis Hart, who works so wonderfully at gathering the news for this week from the pages of the Ames Tribune.
There was plenty of news in the Ames Tribune this past week. Let's start with last Friday, when the Trib reported that the Ames School District had started its last day of the 2020-2021 school year on Thursday with no active cases of the coronavirus among students or staff. And the Nevada and Roland Story School Districts also had reported no recent active cases among students or staff, while Gilbert had one reported case of the virus among students. The Trib also reported that Iowans would no longer be able to use a state website to check their own vaccination histories or those of their children. The Iowa Department of Public Health is limiting public access to the website, partly because of concerns that employers could use it to see if their workers have been vaccinated. There was also word that Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds had signed into law a bill that will establish state grants to help small-scale meat processing plants. She said the meat industry was critical to the state's and nation's food supply. Many big meat processors had shut down at the start of the coronavirus pandemic when the virus started infecting their employees. There was also word that the free composting program offered by the City of Ames had seen increased use during the coronavirus pandemic. Residents can dispose of organic waste in an outdoor bin at 420 East 2nd Street in Ames, 24 hours a day. Among the items that will be accepted, fruit and vegetable scraps, pasta, bread, and cereal, dairy products and eggshells, coffee grounds and tea bags, and pet food. What won't be accepted are such things as plastic, aluminum foil, bones, and diapers. And the Trib reported that Black Lives Matter would celebrate Juneteenth tomorrow, Saturday. It will be held on Marigold Drive from noon to 6 o'clock. Dancing, spoken word poetry, face painting, and water balloons will also be part of the festivities. Saturday's Trib had a story about youth and shelter services in Ames, which celebrated 45 years of service last Thursday. YSS offers financial support and rehabilitation treatment and counseling services, along with other programs to support children, youth, and families. YSS originated from Shelter House, which opened in 1972 as the first non-secure youth emergency shelter in Iowa. Today, YSS has locations in six Iowa cities and offers mentorship programs, counseling and addiction rehabilitation, parenting and life skills education, family foster care and adoption, and more. There was also word that Governor Kim Reynolds was asking for more details about an incident that took place in April, when at least 19 unaccompanied children were transported on an overnight flight through Des Moines from California. They were then taken on two buses and transported to various locations outside the state. The flight had been chartered by the federal government. And the Trib had word that the Boone High School production of Beauty and the Beast, which was staged in March, had won several Iowa High School Musical Theater Awards put out by Des Moines Performing Arts. Those awards included the Most Distinguished Scene, Outstanding Achievement in a Principal Role, and Special Recognition in a Principal Role. Sunday's paper reported that state lawmakers had finished this year's legislative session without tackling racial inequities in the criminal justice system. Governor Reynolds had proposed a measure that would have banned racial profiling by law enforcement and set up a system to track racial data on police stops. Republicans declared that measure dead months before the 2021 session ended. Instead, Republicans passed a bill expanding criminal penalties for protest-related crimes and giving police more legal protections. And the governor backed that bill, saying it was needed to support local law enforcement and crack down on protests that go too far. The Trib also reported that 1 year after the derecho windstorm blew through central Iowa and damaged the Boy Scout camp in Woodward, repairs and improvements have been made, including construction of seven storm shelters. Trees that had been blown down have been removed, and campers will be welcomed back to the camp this weekend. There was also word that outdoor music has come back to the Ames area. From wineries to city parks, the area is offering a series of musical events for the summer. Among those offerings, Roosevelt Summer Sundays concerts in Ames, which kicked off 2 weekends ago with 400 people at Roosevelt Park in attendance. The Ames Municipal Band is performing on Thursday nights at Banshell Park in Ames. Ames on the Half Shell concerts will take place on Fridays at Banshell Park in July. And Prairie Moon Winery north of Ames is hosting Sunday afternoon concerts. And especially for Skywatchers, the trip reported that scientists at the University of Iowa have helped prove some theories about the Northern Lights, otherwise known as the Aurora Borealis. What those scientists have shown is that violent events on the sun, such as solar flares, trigger geomagnetic storms. Those storms tug on the Earth's magnetic field, generate waves that speed through space along that field, and eventually create the conditions that bring about the light that we call the Northern Lights. So now you know. Tuesday's Trib reported that an Iowa company had received a nearly $2.5 million refund after a fraud lawsuit involving coronavirus face masks. The lawsuit was filed by the U.S. Department of Justice against a group called U.S. Fed. A judge determined that Think Safe of Cedar Rapids, which is an emergency preparedness firm, had been defrauded after it had failed to receive the 1 million N95 face masks it had ordered. There was also word that an Iowan who was in one of the nation's most iconic wartime photographs would soon have a monument built in his honor. The Brooklyn, Iowa Community Foundation is leading the effort to build a memorial as a tribute to Harold Keller, the Iowan who helped raise the flag at Iwo Jima in World War II. The life-size bronze statue will be built in Keller's hometown of Brooklyn. The photograph shows 6 Marines hoisting the flag after a 5-week battle for Iwo Jima in 1945. There was also a story about the monetary grant that is letting a music series grow in Ames. The $1,500 award came from the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau. It's letting Stevens Auditorium add 3 shows to this season's Goldfinch on the Lawn series. One of them was set to take place this past Tuesday night, featuring singer-songwriter Kelly Lynn Knott of Minneapolis. And the Trib had several front-page pictures of Ames High's graduation ceremony that took place last Sunday at the Hilton Coliseum in Ames. Wednesday's Trib reported about the public meeting that took place Monday involving one of the 2 finalists for the job of Ames Police Chief. John Justiniano said he would give the department what he called a fresh new perspective on what it's doing right and what it's doing wrong. Justiniano is the deputy chief of police at a naval weapons station in Southern California. He said, among other things, that officers should only use the minimum degree of physical force needed in a situation, and that the school resource officers program is a critical one, that a positive police presence in schools is a benefit to both the police department and the community. The other finalist for the police chief job is Jeff Huff, who has served as interim police chief since last August. There was also word that the FBI had arrested an Iowa man and his adult son after they had discussed on social media their involvement in the January insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. 50-year-old Daryl Johnson of St. Ansgar and his 29-year-old son Daniel of Austin, Minnesota, were picked up last Friday morning. There was also word that the Des Moines Water Works had called on central Iowa residents to cut lawn watering by 25% because of the drought, and more water use limits may soon be on the way. And there was word that the Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride across Iowa next month will recommend that participants wear face masks when social distancing is not possible, and encourage towns across the route to promote outdoor dining at their restaurants and bars. Yesterday's Trib reported that 6 more cases of the coronavirus had been confirmed in Story County. That brought the total number of cases in the county to 10,711 since the pandemic started. The county's 14-day positivity rate was 1.1%. There was also word that Governor Reynolds had signed into law a wide-ranging tax package that cuts income and property taxes, eliminates the state's inheritance tax, and realigns the state's mental health funding system. It also raises tax credits for housing and child care and eliminates payments the state makes to local governments to offset a previous set of commercial property taxes. The governor signed the law Wednesday at the YSS Youth Recovery Home in Ames. Her signature represents the culmination of years of effort by state Republicans. The Trib also reported that proposed exterior standards for Ames homeowners brought more than an hour of public comment on Tuesday evening at the Ames City Council. Some people said the changes target lower-income residents and alternative lawns that benefit the environment. The proposed city ordinance extends standards for rental homes to owner-occupied properties. It would require homeowners to regulate stagnant water, clear debris off sidewalks, limit the time garbage receptacles are left on the curb, and prohibit dense vegetation and the height of vegetation where the property meets public sidewalks and streets. Property owners would receive 3 notices of violations, and if they are ignored, they would be issued a citation. And there was a report that the reunion of a local woman and her father after 40 years apart had prompted NBC's Today Show to interview them. An article about Candy Coulter of Story City and her emotional reconnection with her dad, Dan Bowers, had recently been published in the Tribune. That article caught the attention of the Today Show, which contacted Candy Coulter and asked if she and her dad would share their story. They said yes, and the interview was conducted via Zoom. And among the stories you'll see in today's Trib, word that Governor Reynolds has signed into law the so-called Back the Blue Bill, strengthening legal protections for police officers. And that is your summary of the week's news from the Ames Tribune. I'm Dennis Hart, more than ready, willing, and able to take the weekend off now, but already making plans to return to the same virtual seat on Monday, when I'll report on what's been making news around the state. And there's been plenty of that. Now don't go away, there's lots more straight ahead right here on Local Talk. Have a great weekend.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Doug, how you doing?
All right, let's get the band back
together.
We're
getting that band back together.
You know, we're going to get most of our touring band back together. It's going to be Tom and Doug and Will Stone on drums and Sean Houston on guitar. The Tom and Doug touring band live for one night only here in Ames, Iowa at Dog Eared Books. Why are we doing it, Tom?
To celebrate KHOI-FM, one most wonderful community radio station in the world.
Yes, yes. Not just in Iowa, in the world.
Yes.
And you are part of it, so come on down, support the station, be back in community with people, and listen to Tom and Doug live this Saturday, 7 to 9, Dog-Eared Books, 203 Main Street. I hope to see you there. You too, Tom.
Okay.
Thank you, Dennis Hart, with your week in the news. If you are just tuning in, I am Mike Metz, your host for the hour. I'm sitting in for Pat Schlierbaum, who is currently out of state, but who will be returning hopefully on the 26th. And you just heard a little bit from our famous Tom and Doug group. For those who are new to KHOI, or if you're a listener who for some reason is not familiar with Tom and Doug, you will have a chance this weekend, as they explained. Along with their traveling band, they are performing this Saturday, the 19th, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Dog-Eared Books, located right here at 203 Main Street, just around the corner from KHOI Studios. This is a community fundraiser for our KHOI-FM community radio, so please attend and help support your community radio station. They're going from 7 to 9 p.m., so you can drop in, heckle them a little bit, help us raise some funds for the station, and then go on your merry way and enjoy the rest of the heated evening. So I know that a couple of us will at least make a pop in, and hopefully you can also do the same and support KHOI. Mike, with that, we are going to talk about Josie Mulvihill, who is a young woman from Des Moines, Iowa, who spoke recently at a Black Lives Matter gathering, and Josie was interviewed by KHOI reporter Pat Schlierbaum. So Mike's going to play our interview with her and learn a little bit more about how the murder of George Floyd has changed our perspectives.
Josie, I understand you spoke recently at a Black Lives Matter gathering, and how did that go for you, or what was your message on that day?
It went fine. Public speaking really isn't that hard for me. I was in debate when I was in school, so I don't have a fear of public speaking. I guess I'm lucky about that. But my message really was about that we're still in the midst of the biggest civil rights movement since the 60s, and, you know, we can't accomplish everything we want to accomplish in a year, which means we still have to get out there and we still have to be active in the community, making sure we're talking with our representatives, our mayors, our governors, school board people. We got to, you know, make sure that they know we're still here and we still care about these issues, because I think it is, again, very important to continue to talk about these issues.
We are hoping to establish a dialogue here at KHOI with voices like yours that are attempting to share how George Floyd's murder is changing us. And it sounds like you would like to see a long-term definite changes.
Yes, it is. you know, there's so much legislation that we have to pass, making sure the communities are aware of how to handle these situations. It's not going to be protesting and then that'll fix the issue. It's about creating a long-standing, a substantial change, and that looks like policy, changing policies, changing laws in the way not only the police connect with the community, but as well as our representatives and elected officials.
Recently, the governor signed some legislation concerning this topic. Are you aware of that legislation?
I am. Yes, I am.
Well, go ahead. Let's talk about that. How do you feel that, is that critical race theory legislation going to assist this long-term systemic change that you would like to see, or is it going to be distracting to the long-term change?
I think for there to be long-term change, we not only have to look at the police, but we have to look at systems outside of the police. The piece of legislation I'm really pushing for is the Crown Act, which it adds an amendment to the 1964 Civil Rights Act to include hair texture, meaning that businesses, banks, loan offices, they can't discriminate against somebody for their hair texture. So it's things like that where we have to look not only outside policing, but schooling, you know, or institutions like doctor's offices, banks, institutions outside of policing. I mean, long-standing substantial change doesn't, you can't negate the effects of systemic racism by only focusing on one part of the system.
So you feel the economics of systemic change is going to be something that will benefit all of us in the long run?
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Is there other things that you would like to see that are closely associated with the economic discrimination that you're pointing out?
Yeah, I think another big issue is education. Education is a big part of systemic racism, and I feel we need to close that gap. Redlining not only affected housing, but it affected education, and I would like to see schools get the same funding across the state. That way, there is no gap in education, so we all are eligible for college and getting jobs at similar positions. You know, we all have that equal opportunity. True freedom is not that people are stopping you from doing something, but that you have the ability to do something.
Governor Reynolds is basically saying that the critical race theory, that this discrimination is somewhat of a theory that people are, or you make it sound like it's much more real.
So I think critical race theory gets a bad rep, mainly because people don't understand what it is, or what they hear is not accurate. Critical race theory is, well, critical theory is essentially looking at, for the most part, the systems in our society and how they affect each other. So most times when we're talking about critical theory, we're talking about class rankings and how it affects people in different classes. Well, critical race theory is an intersectional form of that theory. We're looking at the history of the U.S. and the socioeconomic history and combining it and saying, well, this is how these certain things in the past affect this group today. It's not a theory. I mean, we know for a fact that the U.S. has used its systems to oppress minorities of all shapes and sizes. That's not a theory, that's just a fact of the matter, and we can't continue to act like that didn't happen. Otherwise, we're never going to see long-term change, and, you know, we'll just keep doing these movements every 20, 30 years. And that sounds exhausting, in my opinion.
Well, your opinions are appreciated very much along these lines, because this kind of gets back to how has George Floyd's murder changed us? I guess even that posing that question begs that change is necessary, yeah, moving forward in a more empathetic and compassionate manner towards each other. You seem to be expressing that this is not a theory. This is change that needs to occur.
Absolutely. This is very much long overdue change. These are still the rights that Martin Luther King Jr. was advocating for. And I think people get scared to talk about race because it is so uncomfortable, but we have to have that open dialogue between different groups, white people and black people and Asian American, Pacific Islander people and people from the Latinx community. We all need to have an open dialogue about the past and how it still affects us today.
So this is an extension of what you feel the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and things that were started then are still needing attention.
Yes, absolutely.
Josie, you really laid out quite a thesis here. Is there anything else that you would feel complements what you've shared so far?
Yeah, I guess I would wish that more young people and people in general would get involved in their local politics. Go to school board meetings. Try to get a meeting with your mayor. Speak to the people on your city council. Get involved in your local forms of government, because if you can involve yourself locally, then you can understand here are the issues that we're facing locally and here's how we can change them. Local politics always ends up going federal. Governors always end up running for becoming a senator or a president. That's just how it is. So if we can have a better dialogue with our local politicians, then we can affect longer change.
Oh, I think it was Tip O'Neill that said all politics is local. That's where it starts. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that legislator. I think in Massachusetts, kind of more in my generation, but was a part of the civil rights movement, I'm sure, back in the 60s. Thank you so much for accepting our invitation to be on KHOI Community Radio. To lend your voice to this very important issue of how George Floyd is changing us. His murder is really seems to be kind of, do you view it as a turning point?
Yeah, I would agree. I think that history, there are always big historical events that cause us as a society to reckon with the past, and I think this is one of those things.
Anyway.
Actually, I do have a thing coming up. Me and a couple other people from the left side of the aisle are meeting with a couple people from the right side of the aisle, and we plan to have a panel where we discuss issues, and we're all there, are black mm-hmm. conservatives and black leftists and liberals, and we plan to have a panel and discuss contentious issues in the community and how we can create substantial change by reaching across the aisle.
And when is that going to be?
It is going to be 29th, excuse me.
29th, okay.
Yes, we'll be meeting in a room at the Capitol from 10:30 to 11:30.
So June 29th, 10:30 to 11:30, one of the conference rooms in the Capitol. And there'll be a panel discussion, both sides of the aisle represented.
Yes.
I really want to thank you so much, you know, because I just turned 70. So I was maybe your age, you know, maybe a little bit younger when the Civil Rights Act passed, you know. And it was an era of turmoil. But it's just like we keep revisiting the same issues. And so.
Great.
Thank you so much. Keep up the good work. Keep your voice strong. I think you're a credit to your parents and your friends and family. So keep up the good work.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Josie.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, bye for now.
Wow, Josie is a well-spoken young woman, that's for sure. What an interesting conversation interview that she had with Pat. I think we've got a great future if we get more folks to talk about the issues like this and really get out there. And sure, some of us may feel uncomfortable, but this is something that we've got to communicate about. That's part of what KHOI Community Radio is all about, is conversation. So we hope you enjoyed that interview. Thank you, Pat. And now we'll take a music break.
Me smile. It likes to twist my dials. It plays stuff that I like. There's people behind that mic. And those people are folks I know. I get to hear them on the radio. Some speak so musically. We're a community. We're a community filled up with life and art, sharing things truthfully. Speak up right from your heart. My radio don't get paid. It's a little bit renegade. My radio makes me cheer. I like to volunteer. My radio plays good sound. A nice old building here in town. My radio feels alive, and I call it KHOI. We're a community. We're quite diverse and patient. We're a community. And here's our radio station. My radio plays it cool. Its budget is minuscule. Sometimes it's cutting edge. My radio makes me pledge. I listen when I go walk, and I listen to local talk. My radio has no fear. It's just as beautiful as everyone here. We're a community filled up with life and art, sharing things truthfully. Speak up right from your heart. We're a community. We're quite diverse and patient. We're a community. And here's our radio station.
And again, thank you, Tom and Doug. Along with their traveling band, they will be performing this Saturday, the 19th, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Dog-Eared Books, located at 203 Main Street, here in downtown Ames, right around the corner from the Pantorum Building, the luxurious studios of KHOI Community Radio. If you're just joining us and listening in, I'm your host, Mike Metz, substituting or sitting in for Pat Schlierbaum, and we're here along with engineer Mike Murphy, and we will just take a little bit of a music break and welcome our next guests right after. Gosh, that sounds like a catchy little marching tune for a summer camp. Wouldn't you agree, Mike?
Yeah, exactly. I was marching in place.
Okay. Well, we want to welcome Susan Guiazda from the City of Ames along with Keith Abraham. Hello. Susan, do you have anything to tell our listeners prior to getting into the thick of the things with Keith today?
Well, just one thing, just a reminder that Saturday is Yard Waste Free Day, and or what we like to call No Charge Yard Waste Day, because, of course, there is a cost to it, but we just don't charge people individually dumping fees that day. But that is this Saturday from 8 to 4 p.m. at the Green RU Yard Waste site on Friel Drive.
Okay, that sounds great. So, folks, get there early. While the temperatures are still cool, so you're not in an overheated vehicle waiting for you to contribute to the pile that will soon become compost for city use.
And, absolutely.
Yeah. Susan, we know you're going to take a little break next week, so we'll I hope you enjoy that and, you know, take some well-deserved rest, and we'll be waiting for you to join us when you get back from wherever you are going to go recreate.
And speaking...
Oh, that's great to hear.
Yeah. Speaking of recreation or recreation, we've got the man who knows all about that, Keith Abraham. Welcome.
How are you doing today?
Oh, we're doing all right so far. Hey, you've got a bunch of summer camps and other activities starting, and I know you've got some other things to talk about, so I'll let you take the reins here for a minute.
All right. Just jump in, get strapped in, and be ready to go, right?
Right.
So you mentioned summer camps is something that, we did not do last year, but we started up again this year. And what we do is we have 6 weeks of summer camp, and people can register for 1 week at a time, or they can register for all 6 weeks. We actually kicked it off this week, had a great week. We do this outside at Inez Grove Park. We do have, like yesterday with the heat, we did move inside. But they just do a variety of activities. They do nature walks. They do games. They do crafts. Just a wide variety of activities. Every Friday with the program, they do go to Furman Aquatic Center for swimming day, which is it's kind of a good way to finish off each week. And if you're interested in that program, you can, register, go to our website, AmesParkRec.org, or the City of Ames, and then click on Recreation, and you can get to that link. One of the other things that they're doing is every Wednesday they're bringing in guests. It might be the fire department might come with a fire truck and so on and talk about some things, police department. We have Nancy Shaw, our wellness director, is coming out one Wednesday and just doing some wellness and fitness activities with them. I think we have, and Susan can talk more about it, kind of a neighborhood celebration type of thing where we're getting neighborhoods to try to come out and do some banners, and but also having the kids do some yard signs that we're going to post in front of City Hall for the 4th of July. So they're coming out next week, to do that. So it's a great thing. So we have 5 weeks left. You can still register. We've been getting about 50 kids a week that have been signed up so far. So that's a good thing.
So it's making learning fun, like all camps should be. You learn a little something, but you have a great time. It's great to hear a lot of those voices, those squeals of excitement outside, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I should mention that it's held Monday through Friday, 1 to 5 p.m. Those are the hours for our summer camps. Another thing that we have going, it actually starts on Monday, but if you haven't registered, you could still do that. You have a youth sand volleyball program that's starting up for 3rd through 6th graders. That starts on Monday, the 21st, but you could still register for that program if you would like. We are also starting pickleball leagues. I don't know if you're a pickleball player, but if you're interested, you want to kind of give it a try. We do have a league. We have a variety of different we have an adult, we have a senior league, we have a couples league, but those leagues are going to start the 29th. So I believe you can still register for that program as well. So again, you can go to our website. And another activity that we have going on is water polo. With the heat that we've been having, if you want to get a little exercise and cool off in the water at the same time, water polo on Wednesday evenings from 8 to 9 p.m. At Furman Aquatic Center is another activity that we have. In addition to the Furman Aquatic Center, which you can go there, and we have from 11 to 1 each day, we have tot time, which is for kids 7 and under and their parents. We also have lap swimming, and then we have water walking. We also have water walking from 7 to 8 in the evening on Sundays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays. And then from 1 to 8 every day, we have open swim, which we've been having a lot of attendance, a lot of people coming out to the pool, which has been a great thing. And if you really want to cool off, Mike, head to the ice arena. You know, we have open skates. We have a number of different things. We have pickup hockey. And like I said, open skates throughout the week. And we do have those calendars on our website as well, so you can kind of see what might be of interest to you and go out and enjoy.
You know, as a grade schooler growing up in Wisconsin, it was almost like you had to learn hockey. And when you first start out, it's a lot of pickup hockey. You're picking yourself up off the ice.
Yeah. That's I didn't play much hockey, and I grew up in Wisconsin as well. Didn't play much hockey, but in college I played. My neighbors were playing. They said, "Oh, we need some more players." It seemed like every time I got down to one end of the ice, Mike, the puck was on the other end. So I'd run into the boards. I'd turn myself around. And by the time I got down to the other end, the puck was down on the other side.
You're one of those, you know, you're big enough that they saw you coming and said, "Get the puck out of here. Keith's coming." And you can tell I quit early because I have all my front teeth.
I think we'll go with that one, Mike.
Okay. Keith, what else have you got? I know Miracle Park is coming up. We should mention that.
Yes, we do have, and again, this has been open. People have been going there like crazy. And we have gotten nothing but positive comments from people going up there. We also have, the Miracle League. We started that. We have that 2 weeks of games left. But on June 26th, that morning, we're going to do a celebration for the Miracle Park. With the pandemic, we hadn't been able to do this. We were going to do something last November, but that got delayed. So on the 26th, what we're going to do is starting at 8:30, we have some different activities. We have Tim Reed's going to be out there doing some caricatures. We have like a petting zoo, some animals that are going to be there. We're going to do a speed throwing activity. We'll have some refreshments. That starts at 8:30. Then at 9 o'clock, we will have the last Miracle game for the spring season. And if you haven't seen a Miracle League game, you should come out and watch it. The players, the athletes just have an awesome time. Just really enjoy it. And then after the game, roughly about 10 o'clock, then we're going to be doing ribbon cutting. So we'll have, the mayor will welcome everybody. I'll go through some of the history. And then the Ames Foundation, who was critical in this project, they did most of the fundraising. Of $2.3 million, for it. They also manage the contract. They'll have an opportunity to thank all of their donors. So it's really a thanks to the community, the individuals, to the organizations that really stepped up and made that Miracle Project a reality. And again, people are just loving it. Well, that's June 26th, Saturday, June 26th.
Okay, that sounds great. And hopefully the weather will be a little less heat-induced, because next week we're supposed to have a little more reasonable temperatures, we hope. So.
Yep.
That'll
Let's
be great.
So.
Yeah. Anything else you want to add, Keith?
Yeah, we're just two more things. One, just remind everybody that the municipal band concerts are up and running again Thursday nights at 8 o'clock. And on July 8th, Simon Estes will be there. And we'll also be doing council night at the band shell. So we'll be council members will be handing out ice cream, different variety of ice cream on that night. And we'll also be doing a kind of a ribbon cutting for the electrical and lighting project that we finished up this past year. And then just one last thing I'll just mention to viewers is coming up here most likely in July. City Council did just award a contract to Woodruff Construction to do some renovations of the accessible fishing pier out at Ada Hayden. So coming up here, look for signs that will be closed for a period of time. We'll be meeting with Woodruff Construction here shortly and getting firm up the dates for when they're going to actually do the work. But that is something that people should be aware of is coming down the line.
Okay, that sounds great. And another water-related activity. Get some more folks out who maybe haven't had a chance to do that once that's completed.
Yep. Fish are a little tough to bite right now, but I've been going out to Ada Hayden and have some luck. So yeah, if you're well, there's a lot of fishing opportunities out there, so give it a try.
Yeah, sounds great, Keith. Thank you. Susan, have you got anything else?
Well, we have been getting a couple of inquiries into Rummage Rampage. That's another event that was put off last year. We went on hiatus. Just to refresh your memory, Rummage Rampage is the community-wide garage sale that is held in the intermodal facility on Hayward. Basically, we take donations on Friday, July 30th, and from noon to 6, we get a lot of donations. And then for a week long, we hold a garage sale that is staffed by nonprofit organizations that send volunteers. And that event continues for a week. We take donations all week long, so the inventory changes over. That's a time where a lot of people are moving. In a community like Ames, we get a lot of transition that July to August timeframe. And so as people are transitioning, maybe leaving one place and moving out of Ames or coming into Ames, there's a lot of needs, one for disposal of items, and two, that they need to reestablish households. So it's really a great opportunity to donate items that you don't need and not to leave them at the curbside, but to repurpose them and also to do a little shopping if you don't have a lot of money, but you need a lot of things. So we are definitely looking forward to that. We're getting a lot of calls. Unfortunately, we don't have a place to store product right now. So we ask people, if you have product that's good, please use Goodwill, Salvation Army, Overflow Thrift Store. Use some of the resources that we have available now. But if you can hold on to items, we will get them at the end of July.
Sounds like a great deal. Like you say, a good way to repurpose things that don't end up in our resource recovery and potentially the landfill and things like that. It's good to reuse things as much as possible. That's great. Susan, Keith, thank you for joining us. Enjoy your time away, Susan, and we'll expect to see you outdoors. Thank you both.
Sounds good, Mike. All right. Thanks much.
Have a great weekend.
All right. Yep. Bye-bye. Mike, you took an opportunity to accompany Dr. Tom Rosberg, who's a longtime Story County resident. He's a prairie ecologist, and he's also a professor at Drake University. He led the first prairie walk out at Doolittle Prairie, our largest piece of remnant native prairie. You got any thoughts to share about your first prairie walk out there?
Well, it was just beautiful, and it's great to have someone interpret for you, because I can look and see, like, the totality of the landscape, but someone like Tom could drill down to, here's what this plant is, here's what feeds off it, here's mm-hmm. why it's important, here's why this shouldn't be here, it's invasive, or things like that. So it was great to have that type of interpretation, so I had a better, more informed sense of what I was looking at.
Yeah, he's got a good way to pull all that together. So let's listen to Tom.
So maybe we should get started. It's trying to rain a little bit. So welcome to the first monthly prairie hike here at Doolittle Prairie. I'm Tom Rosberg, a professor of biology at Drake University, and spent 12 years at Iowa State. So we can wear the Iowa State hat too, I guess. Yeah, I lead these monthly hikes. The fourth Thursday of the month is the regular date. I just took a quick hike out there, and there are things blooming. I think the earliness and also just the cool weather. I mean, man, it's been pretty cool. Seems like to me this spring things are a little bit slower. But we have the advantage of having a prescribed burn here on the south side, the south section here of Doolittle. And that has helped push some things on a little bit further. We can see some things blooming there. And we can talk about fire ecology a bit too, because we can walk a little trail down there a ways where the fire break was, the fire lane was. And we can see kind of what happens when you burn versus what happens when you don't burn. So Doolittle Prairie is a state preserve. This land that you see out here is just 26 acres or so of state preserve here. A state preserve is sort of the highest designation that any piece of land can receive in the state of Iowa. And there's sort of five criteria that are used to justify it: biological, geological, zoological, archaeological, and aesthetic. Doolittle is a geological and biological primarily because of the plant life here and the geology, which again represents the Des Moines Lobe. Des Moines Lobe is this feature in Iowa, the north central part of the state that was recently, you know, just in the blink of an eye in terms of geological timescales, glaciated just 14,000 to 12,000 years ago. Massive sheet of ice sitting where we are right here. This is a young landscape. The landscape here is really young geologically. If you were to go, you know, on the other side of Des Moines, go south on Highway 35, you get into the Southern Iowa Drift Plain. That has not been glaciated for over 500,000 years. So huge difference there. And you probably notice as you drive south, it starts getting much more rolling and topographically more fun because there's hills and valleys. That happens because all of that time, 500,000 years, the landscape has been developing. There's been rain, precipitation, opportunity for rivers to form, an opportunity for what we call external drainage, which means rivers to form. This is a really young landscape, and so most of the drainage up here is internal. And that's why there's so many potholes. The Des Moines Lobe is known for its potholes. It's part of the Prairie Pothole Complex, and that's an important feature here as well. This was land that was first homesteaded by William Doolittle in 1855. Of course, back then, things were much different. There was prairie everywhere. There were potholes all over the place. It was certainly a rough landscape to make a living on. Those settlers plowed their way through, started plowing up the prairie, of course, converting land to prairie to farmland. Now, why do you suppose Doolittle Prairie is still here then? Why didn't it get plowed up? Use it for grazing, right? There were at least some farmers utilized the prairie as basically hay or as a pasture. When they utilized it for hay, which was pretty much what was done here, they really didn't do too much to it. They cut the hay once a year, and that's really not that bad for a prairie. You know, it sort of actually simulates what happens when you burn a prairie. When farmers decided to really focus on grazing and maybe transform a prairie into a pasture, that sometimes, you know, had more devastating effects, because what they would do then is they would fertilize it and they would put herbicide on it later when those things came along. And they would, of course, introduce non-native cool season grasses, forage grasses that are not native. That's going to represent a more significant change. But at least, again, that's not quite as bad as plowing, of course. Prairies survive mainly because farmers found a way to use them without plowing them up. This whole area was used for prairie hay, mostly up in the northern half, and that is the best part of the site. The highest quality prairie is in the north part, where, again, it was primarily used for prairie hay, cut once a year. This section down here, the south side, was used more intensively for grazing, and a portion of it in the southwest corner was actually plowed up and row crop for a while. That section has been, at least an attempt has been made to sort of restore it using seeds from on site. And of course, this sort of strip across or along the lane here was also planted. In fact, that was planted in the 1980s. The grandchildren of William Doolittle sold the property to the DNR in 1979. That's when it became public. It was recognized right away as being so important. It was made a state preserve the next year. There have been, of course, lots of surveys done out here. Folks from Iowa State have been out here. A friend of mine has done some inventories out here. And there's a paper on the vegetation here. 220 native plant species have been observed here. That's pretty high when you think about, again, the amount of area this is here, 220. There's a few non-natives as well, of course. It's classified, or I would at least classify it as a what we call a wet mesic prairie. Wet mesic means that it's got sort of a medium amount of moisture. Mesic is a term we use to describe a soil that is moist, really supports growth, but it's also well drained, so it's not waterlogged or anything. but it has enough moisture in the soil to support good growth of plants. So when we say wet mesic, that means that it's a little bit wetter than that. Or when I say dry mesic, that means it's a little bit drier than that. What we have here is a sort of wet mesic prairie, and then it integrates into wetlands. And those potholes, and there's about 14 or so potholes that have been mapped on the whole site, most of them, again, on the northern part. Those are shallow basins. I think probably, you know, standing water, when you're really wet, you can probably maybe get a couple feet of water or so in them. So we'll take a look at one. There's not much water in them now, of course, because of the drought. But it has sort of a combination of wetlands grading into wet mesic prairie. And there's actually even a few small places on the high-quality section down there that might even be mesic, because they're just a little bit higher and the soil might be just a little bit more porous, and so the soil drains more. Any quick questions? All right, well, let's go see what we can find out here. Here's the first flower right here, little purple one right here. And I want to stop here because it's hard to find this species up there, because that area up there, again, is higher quality. And I want you to see that. I want you to compare and kind of get a taste for what we see here and then be able to compare it up there. Of course, the big difference is going to be that this has been burned here. That has not. Things are a little bit, well, there's plenty of things blooming, but the only violets I can find up there right now are the common blue violet. This is a prairie violet right here. And so it's a little more of a prairie species. The common blue violet is that violet you can find in your backyard. It grows all over the place. This one you recognize as a prairie violet because of the leaves here. They have this very deeply lobed characteristic. You know, your common blue violet just has sort of a heart-shaped leaf, but doesn't have the lobes that we can see here. So this is Viola petitifida, the prairie violet. And I want you to see also that, again, we're going to talk about the burn, but this, again, is a section that had more of a intense, you know, use, more grazing, and that probably explains in part at least the presence of a lot of this grass, because most of what we see here, this grass, is either smooth brome or Kentucky bluegrass. Those are two species that are really common forage grasses, introduced, not native, of course, and we call them cool season grasses because they have a photosynthetic pathway that is best suited to cooler parts of the growing season. They need a little bit more moisture because of that as well. And we sometimes, again, contrast those grasses, the cool season. There are both native and non-native cool season grasses, but we'll contrast those probably later in the summer when we can see more of the warm season grasses. We're not going to see much of them right now. They're called warm season grasses. Has anyone felt any warmth yet? They're not doing much yet. So again, what I want you to see here is it's going to be a little bit hard because that's not burned, and this is. When you burn a site like this, that does kind of speed up some of the growth a little bit. You'll see, you know, of course, right after the burn, there's not much out there. But within the following week, at least, you'll often see, you know, stuff getting started and getting going. Why do you suppose that is? Why do we see, like, what you're going to see here compared with, and we can go down here to the burn line, I guess, and maybe see it better. But you'll see, in some cases, especially, you know, a couple of weeks after a burn, you'll see stuff really growing pretty well and probably growing a little bit better than, say, a patch of ground that was not burned right next to it. The ground being warmer, that's the big one. Yeah, it looks like it's pretty brown down here, so whether or not it got girdled or not, these got leaves on them, so it may not be dead. It doesn't look like it's quite dead. It may not have gotten hot enough down there. Yeah, and I don't know for sure when this burn was done, but it looks like to me that that's still alive. If it gets hot enough at the base, it can kill the phloem tissue. It's on the outside of the stem, and then that can effectively top kill the plant. It depends upon, again, if fuel was here and how long the fire was burning around that base. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it's mainly the fact that you remove all of that litter and thatch. The dead vegetation from years of growth, that it doesn't break down real fast. It breaks down, but slowly. And so in a prairie, what will happen if there is no fire from 1 year to the next is that each year's growth begins to accumulate. That develops into a layer of mulch. Now, what happens when you mulch your garden? When you mulch your garden, that's going to slow any seedlings from coming up. And that's why you usually do it. It will help hold moisture in. But it also keeps the ground cooler, because now you got that layer of litter on top of the ground, and that reflects some of the light, and you don't get as much solar radiation going into the soil. Especially, again, when you burn, you remove all of that, you create a black surface. It's very absorbent, of course. Soil temperatures increase more quickly after the burn. Why would that be important? What has to happen for these plants to begin growing? What has to be happening below ground there? For anything to grow, you have to have respiration. Respiration is highly dependent on temperature. If you're talking about a cold soil, respiration rates of the roots in the cold soil are going to be slow. As that soil warms up, respiration rates can increase because the temperature is just a physical fact. Respiration increases as a function of temperature. As the soil temperature warms up, then respiration rates can increase in the roots. That's what has to happen for plants to begin growing. In order to have new tissue forming and growth to happen, you have to have respiration. You have to be using the food resources that the roots have to grow new tissue. So it's mainly, there's many things that happen, and we're not going to be able to cover everything, but I would say that the warming of the soil, more access to light, too, because, again, if there's a layer of litter like that, the new shoots that are coming up into a layer of thatch. There's not much light there. They're actually in the shade. Coming up into a sunny environment, a much warmer soil, gets them going, gives everything a jump start. One more quick thing. Here's a prairie plant here. This is Rattlesnake Master. Here's another big clump of violets right here, prairie violets. Here's some gray-headed coneflower, another prairie plant. And what I want you to see here is that the grasses, this is brome. These are mostly all bromes in through here. The wider-leafed grass is brome. The more narrow-leafed grasses are Kentucky bluegrass. Those are the non-native species. This was burned, and all these plants were, I don't know what it looked like when they burned, but the cool season grasses would have been starting, certainly. They like it when it's cool. Prairie plants were starting, but then it was burned. I don't know how much fuel was here for sure, and I didn't see the burn. And I think it's been at least a few years since this was burned, so there was pretty good fuel load, probably. I'm guessing that, after the burn, anything that was growing or green here was probably top killed, because there would have been enough heat and fire to do that. But look what's happening now. Which plants look like they're adapted to prairies because they are better able to cope with fire? Look at that big plant compared to this little spindly brome. It wasn't hurt by that fire. Boom, it's coming right back. Here's a violet. Again, here's the gray-headed coneflower. All of these prairie plants out here that you can see, all the sort of the big plants, there's some compass plants. They're all way ahead of the brome now. The brome is, and the idea would be is the brome, the non-native plants, again, the ones that aren't native to prairie, to North America, have not evolved with fire. They aren't able to cope with fire as well. That's an important thing, I think. It helps to see it like this, but it's an important argument, I think, that can be made for the importance of using a tool like fire in the effort to sort out who's the real prairie plant and who's the non-native. We want to try to remove or at least push back on those non-natives as much as possible.
So the next prairie walk out at Doolittle is this coming Thursday with Dr. Tom Rosberg. So get out there. You'll see something different every time you go out there for those monthly walks during the summer months. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m. and 5 p.m. on Friday at 89.1 FM. Thank you, Local Talk producers Ursula Rudenberg and Lynn Carey, and thank you, Dennis Hart, for your Friday report. Thank you, Mike Murphy, for engineering, and thank our guests Susan Guiazda and Keith Morgan. I am Mike Metz, your host. I'm sitting in for Pat Schlierbaum. Remember, you, the listener, are what make KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
This is Dennis Malsby at KHOI 89.1, Story City, Ames.